If she stopped for supper, she probably didn't get home until close to midnight. Silence from Henry. I take it she stayed for lunch. Did you go with him to the art museum?
You know we don't have to discuss this. There's really nothing to say. I'd just as soon drop the subject.
Sure, no problem, I said. Are you going to Rosie's for supper? I was thinking of doing that myself.
And risk running into Lewis? I think not.
We could go somewhere else. Emile's at the beach is always lovely.
He looked at me with such injury in his eyes I couldn't bear to see it. She broke it off.
She did?
She said I was impossible. She said she really couldn't bear my bad behavior.
What brought that on?
Nothing. It came out of a clear blue sky.
Maybe she had a hard day.
Not as hard as mine.
I sat staring at the floor, feeling a wave of disappointment washing over me. I had such high hopes for them. I said, "You know what I find hard? I want to believe nice things can happen to us. Not every day, maybe, but just now and then."
"Me too," he said.
He got up and left the room. I waited a minute, and when it was clear he wasn't coming back, I dumped my wine in the sink, rinsed the glass, and then let myself out. I was ready to wring William's neck, and I wouldn't have minded having a go at Lewis while I was at it. I could have handled pain of my own easier than Henry's. Part of my bleak mood was probably connected to my lack of sleep, but it didn't feel that way. It felt deep and permanent, a darkness being stirred up like silt from the very depths. Henry was a great guy, and Maddie'd seemed perfect for him. He probably had been impossible, but so had she in her way. What would it have taken to be a little more sensitive to the situation? Unless she didn't care much to begin with, I thought. In that case, she'd cut and run the minute things got tough. As a person with cut-and-run tendencies myself, I could see her point. Life was difficult enough without having to put up with someone else's petulance. I let myself into my apartment and checked the answering machine. I was hoping Cheney'd left a message, but the light wasn't blinking, so I kissed that one off. Despite my earlier self-confidence, I wasn't keen on the idea of waiting around to see if he'd call. It was dinner time, but I wasn't any more willing than Henry to venture into Rosie's. William would prance over, taking his own pulse and asking for the latest in the lover's progress report. In case he was ignorant of the breakup, I didn't want to be the one to tell him. And if he'd heard it from Lewis, I didn't want to listen to him minimize the role he'd played. I suspected a run would cheer me up, but given my current mental state, I'd have to jog all the way to Cottonwood 20 miles round trip. This was one of those moments when you need a girlfriend. When you're down in the dumps, that's what you do. Call your best friend, or so I've heard. You chat, you laugh. You tell her your sad tale of woe, she commiserates, and then you take off and go shopping like normal folk. But I didn't have a girlfriend. Alack, I'd hardly noticed until Cheney appeared. So now not only was I facing the fact that I didn't have him, I didn't have her either, whoever she was. A voice said, "Ah, but you do have Reba." I thought about that one. If I made a list of desirable girlfriend traits, convicted felon wouldn't be one. On the other hand, I'd be a convicted felon myself if I'd ever been caught doing even half the things I'd done. I picked up the phone and punched in the number for the Lafferty estate. When Reba answered, I said, "Reba, this is Kinsey. I need a favor. How good are you at giving fashion advice?" Reba picked me up in her car, a 2-year-old black BMW she'd acquired shortly before she'd been sent to CIW. The DA was panting to seize the car on the premise I'd bought it with ill-gotten gains. Ha 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 on him. My father gave it to me for my 30th birthday. Hopes dashed again. "What did you say to Ani when you canceled dinner?" "I told her something came up and we'd make it another night." "She was cool with that?" Of course. She probably hated the idea of having dinner with me. I was always pouring my heart out about Beck. There wasn't anyone else I could talk to about him. Beck said this, Beck said that. When it came to our sex life, I'd be giving her a blow-by-blow, so to speak. Oh, that was your mistake. You made him sound too good. You got that right. She was always jealous of me. Minute my back is turned, she walks up with my job, and then she walks off with the love of my life, or so I thought at the time. I hate women who get into that competitive shit. What's she like? You can judge for yourself, as long as you end up agreeing with me. I know where she hangs out. If you're interested, we can drop by later, and I'll introduce you. Drop by where? Bubbles, in Montebello. That's been closed for 2 years. Nuh-uh. The place has changed hands. Name's the same, but it's been open for a month under new management. Where are we headed now? The mall. Passages, the newly opened shopping plaza in the heart of Santa Teresa, had been designed to resemble an old Spanish town. The architecture featured a picturesque assortment of narrow, shoulder-to-shoulder buildings of varying heights, arches, loggias, courtyards, fountains, and side streets, the whole of the three-block complex capped by red tile roofs. At ground level, there were restaurants, clothing stores, galleries, jewelry stores, and other retail shops. The wide central esplanade was anchored at one end by Macy's and at the other end by Nordstrom's, with a large chain bookstore occupying a prominent spot. Pepper trees and flowering shrubs were planted throughout. In the taller structures, 3 and 4 stories high, office space had been leased to lawyers, accountants, engineers, and anyone else who could afford the staggering rents. Given Santa Teresa's resistance to new construction, the project had taken years to push through. The City Planning Commission and the Architectural Board of Review, plus the City Council, plus the County Board of Supervisors, plus the Building and Safety Commission, all at odds with one another, had to be soothed, pacified, and reassured. Citizens' groups protested the raising of buildings 5 and 6 decades old, though most were otherwise unremarkable. Many were already slated for mandatory earthquake retrofitting, which would have cost the owners more than they were worth. Environmental impact studies had to be approved. Numerous small merchants were evicted and displaced, with only one holdout, a funky little bar called Dale's that was still moored in the middle of the plaza like a tugboat in a harbor full of yachts. We ate dinner at an Italian boutique restaurant located on one of the smaller avenues that connected the center esplanade to State Street on one side and Chapel on the other. Temperatures were still elevated, and we elected to eat on the patio outside. As the dark came down, the landscape lighting began to paint walls and vegetation in colors more vivid than their daylight shades. Details of wrought iron fixtures were picked out in shadow, the plaster frieze along the roof outlined in black. If you squinted, you could almost believe you'd been transported to a foreign country. While we waited for our salads, I said, "I appreciate your doing this, the clothes thing." "No problem. It's obvious you need help." I'm not sure the word obvious should come into play. Trust me. Later, while she was winding spaghetti on her fork, she said, "You know, this is Beck's project." "What is?" "The mall." "He did passages?" "Sure. I mean, not on his own, in partnership with a guy in Dallas, another developer. Beck moved his office to the far end, down by Macy's. The fourth floor runs the full block between State and Chapel." I didn't realize the building covered that much ground. "Because you didn't bother to look up. If you did, you'd see that there are covered walkways that join the second and third levels in places above the esplanade. Technically, in the rainy season, you could move from one building to the other without getting wet." "You've got a better eye than I do. I miss that." "I have the advantage. The mall's been in development for years, so I've seen the plans at just about every stage. Beck moved his office in a couple of months after I went into CIW, so I never got to see it. Turned out great, or so I hear." I took a sip of wine, finishing the last bite of eggplant parmesan while I watched Reba use a chunk of bread to clean up her marinara sauce. I said, "Where are you going with this?" She popped the bread in her mouth, smiling while she chewed. "You're the kick-ass private eye. You figure it out. In the meantime, let's go buy you some clothes, and then we can make the run into Montebello." Chapter 15. We shopped until the stores closed at 9. Reba kept up a running commentary as I tried things on. In the interests of education, she let me make my choices without reference to her opinion. At first, I tried gauging her reaction as I lifted a garment off the rack, but she looked on with the same deadpan expression she must have donned at the poker table. With no guidelines whatever, I picked out 2 dresses, a pantsuit, and 3 cotton skirts. "Okay," I said. Her brow went up about 1/8 of an inch. "That's it? Isn't this enough? You like that green deal, that pantsuit thing?" "Well, yeah, you know, it's dark and it won't show spots." "All right," she said, with a tone suggesting you have to let kids make boo-boos in order for them to learn. She trailed behind me as far as the line of dressing cubicles in the rear. She looked on idly while I opened door after door, trying to find a room not in use. When I finally found an empty cubicle, she gave every impression of following me in. "Hold on a sec, you're coming in here with me? What if something doesn't fit? You can't stroll around out there in your underwear." "I wasn't planning to. I was going to try on stuff back here and then decide." "Deciding is my job. You try on clothes and I'll explain how misguided you are." She sat on a plain wooden chair in a space that was 6 feet on a side with floor-to-ceiling mirrors on 3. The fluorescent lighting guaranteed your skin would look sallow and every tiny body flaw would appear in bas-relief. I took my shoes off and began to strip down with the same enthusiasm I feel before a pelvic exam. "I can tell I have a better-developed sense of modesty than you do," I said. "Oh, please. Prison knocked that out of me. The shower stalls were 1/4 this size, with these skimpy canvas curtains designed to keep your head and feet in view. That was to prevent the inmates from having sex in private. Little did they know. Aside from that, you might as well forget privacy altogether. It was simpler to prance around nude like everybody else." During these revelations, I was trying to step gracefully out of my blue jeans, but my foot caught and I nearly toppled sideways. Reba pretended not to notice. I said, "Didn't that bother you?" "At first, but after a while I thought, oh, who gives a damn? All these naked women, and pretty soon you've seen every possible body type. Short, tall, skinny, fat, little tits, big ass, or big tits and no ass. Scar, moles, tattoos, birth defects. Everybody looks just about like everybody else." I peeled my t-shirt over my head. "Oh, bullet holes," she said, nearly clapping her hands as she caught sight of mine. "Do you mind?" "Well, I think they're cute, sort of like dimples." I slid the first of 2 cotton dresses from the hanger and eased my arms up the interior and out the requisite armholes. I turned to the mirror. I looked about like I always did. Not bad, but not that good. "What do you think? What do you think? Come on, Reba, just tell me what's wrong with it." "Everything. The color, for starters. You should wear clear tones, red, maybe navy blue, but not that pukey shade of yellow. It makes your skin tone look orange." "I thought that was the lighting. And look how loose it's cut. You've got good legs and a great set of boobs. I mean, they're not huge, but they're sassy, so why cover them with something that looks like a pillowcase? I don't like to wear stuff too tight." "Clothes are supposed to fit, dear. That dress is one size too big, and it looks, dare I say, so matronly. Go ahead and try on the blue print skirt, but I can tell you right now it's another pass. You're not the big-ass Hawaiian palm and parrot type. If you already hate it, why should I try it on? Because otherwise you'll never get the point." And so it went. Bossy women and I get along swimmingly, as I'm a masochist at heart. I bypassed the blue print skirt and didn't bother trying on the green pantsuit, knowing she'd be right about that, too. She removed the offending garments, holding the hangers at arm's length like so many dead rats. While I waited in the dressing room, she went out to the floor and flipped through the racks. She returned with 6 items, which she exhibited one by one, creating the illusion that she was letting me choose. I resisted 1 dress and 1 skirt, but everything else she selected ended up looking great on me, even if I do say so myself. "I don't understand how you know all this stuff," I said, getting dressed again. "This is my perpetual complaint, that somehow other women have a flair for things that make me feel like a dunce." It was like thought problems in math. In high school, the minute I encountered one, I'd feel like I was on the verge of blacking out. "You'll get the hang of it eventually. It's really not that hard." At CIW, I was the resident styling maven. Hair, makeup, clothes, all of it. I could have taught a class. She paused to check her watch. "Let's get a move on. Time to party." We sped south on the 101 with Reba at the wheel. I said, "I'm not sure this is smart. Why go to a place where everyone's drinking?" "I'm not going there to drink. I haven't had a drink for 23 months, 14 and a half days." "Then why put yourself in harm's way?" "I told you, because that's where Ani is. She goes out every Thursday night to hustle guys." I opened my mouth to protest, but she shot me a look. "You're not my mother, okay? I promise I'll call my sponsor the minute I get home. At least I would if I had one, which I don't." Bubbles was a Montebello wine and champagne bistro that had once done a lively business in concert with the Edgewater Hotel and another high-priced piano bar called Spirits. The three were in easy driving distance of one another and formed a triangle traveled by every rich, hot, single person on the market back then. All three places were heavy on atmosphere, glitz, glitter, live music, small dance floors, and low lights. Drinks were pricey, served in oversized glasses, and food was an afterthought, meant to get you home again without a fatal accident. In the mid-70s, for reasons unknown, Bubbles became a magnet for escort services, girls working high-end outcall, and models from Los Angeles who drove to Montebello cruising for love. Eventually, cocaine became prevalent, and the county sheriff's department stepped in and shut the place down. I'd been there on occasion because my second husband, Daniel, was a jazz pianist who played the 3 night spots in rotation. Early in the relationship, I realized if I didn't make a point of being there with him, I might not see him until breakfast the next day. He claimed he was out jamming with the guys, which turned out to be true, in both the literal and metaphorical senses. We pulled up to the left of the entrance. Reba handed her car keys to the valet, and we went in. Men in suits and sport coats stood 5 and 6 deep at the bar, checking out our boobs and butts as we passed. Reba did a quick search from table to table while I followed in her wake. Bubbles hadn't changed. Illumination was achieved primarily by way of massive fish tanks that lined the walls and separated one seating area from the next. In the main room, there was a bar with a U-shaped border of booths and a scattering of tables big enough for 2. In the second room, through a wide arch, a jazz combo, piano, saxophone, and bass, was set up on a wide deck above a dance floor the size of a trampoline. The music was mellow, haunting melodies from the 40s that stuck in your head for days. This was not a place where voices were raised or raucous laughter cut through the murmur of civilized conversation. No one got drunk and tumbled backward into other patrons. Women didn't weep or fling drinks on their dates. No one upchucked in the elegant restrooms with their marble floors and baskets of tiny terry cloth towels. Customers smoked, but the ventilation system was high-tech, and a roving band of busboys whisked away dirty ashtrays and replaced them with clean ones every 5 minutes or so. Reba put a hand out and slowed me to a halt. Like a pointer, she stood and pinned a look on Ani, who sat at a table by herself, smoking a cigarette with an air of indifference I suspected was fake. The presence of two half-filled champagne flutes and a bottle resting in a nearby cooler suggested a companion who'd left the table moments before. The real Ani bore only passing resemblance to the Ani I'd seen in the grainy black-and-white photos. She was tall and slim, with a long, thin face, wide nose, thin lips, and small, nearly lashless eyes. Her dark hair was dead straight and spilled across her shoulders with the high, silky shine you see in ads for shampoos. Silver earrings dangled from her lobes and brushed against her neck with every move of her head. The jacket of her black business suit had been shrugged aside, revealing a white silk tank top that looked more like a slip than any blouse I'd seen. Taken feature by feature, she really wasn't pretty, but she managed to maximize her assets. Her makeup was artful, and her breasts looked as hard as croquet balls inserted inexplicably under the skimpy flesh on her chest. Nonetheless, she presented herself as though she were beautiful, and that was the impression that prevailed. Reba moved forward with trumped-up exuberance.
Ani! How perfect! I was hoping you'd be here!
Hello, Reba. Ani's manner was cool, but Reba didn't seem to notice as she slid into a chair. I sat down, too, fully aware Ani wasn't at all happy to see us. Beside her, Reba seemed childlike, animated, petite, with dark, tousled hair, the large, dark eyes, perfect nose, and delicately rounded chin, where Ani's receded slightly. What Reba lacked was that air of self-containment that passes for breeding among middle-class pretenders. Reba said, "This is my friend Kinsey. I've been telling her about you." Her gaze settled on the two champagne flutes as though she'd just noticed.
"I hope we're not cutting in on your action, big hot date."
"It's actually not a date. Beck and I had to work late, so he suggested stopping off for a nightcap. I don't imagine we'll stay long."
"Beck's here? That's great. I don't see him."
"He's chatting with a friend." "I'm sorry you canceled dinner. When you said something came up, I pictured AA."
"I did a meeting already. I'm only required to do one a week."
Reba helped herself to one of Ani's cigarettes and waggled it between her teeth.
"You have a light for this?"
"Of course." Ani reached into a small bag and came up with a pack of matches. Reba took the pack, struck one, and cupped a hand around the flame. She inhaled with satisfaction and returned the matches with a sly smile that Ani seemed to miss. I knew Reba well enough by now that I could see the icy rage sparkling in her eyes. She pulled the ashtray closer and then put an elbow on the table and propped her chin on her hand.
"So, how are things with you? You said you'd write, but then I never heard from you."
"I wrote. I sent you a card. Didn't you get it?" Reba took a drag of her cigarette, her smile still in place.
"That's right. So you did. It had bunnies on it, as I remember. One measly card in 22 months. Hey, don't put yourself out."
"I'm sorry if that bothers you, but I was busy. You left the office in bad shape. It took me months to straighten it out."
"Yeah, well, the Department of Corrections had first claim. Whisk you off to prison, you don't have the option to stop by your workplace and tidy up your desk. I'm sure you have the situation well in hand."
"Finally, no thanks to you." Ani's gaze shifted slightly. Reba turned her head in time to see Beck approaching from the bar. He caught sight of her, and his forward motion halted for a split second, like a few frames of film missing from a sequence. Reba's face brightened. She pushed out of the chair and moved toward him. When she reached him, her arm slid around his neck as though she meant to kiss him on the mouth. He extracted himself gently.
"Hey, hey, hey, gorgeous. We're in public, remember?"
"I know, but I missed you."
"Well, I missed you too, but suppose one of Tracy's girlfriends is here."
He steered her back to her chair, sending me a smile in the process.
"Good to see you again."
"Nice seeing you," I said, though it wasn't nice at all.
Not surprisingly, my view of him had changed radically. When I'd met him in Rosie's, I thought he was handsome, long-limbed, loose-jointed, with that lazy half-smile. Even his eyes, which I'd thought were a rich chocolate brown, now looked as dark as volcanic stone. Seeing him with Ani, I could sense the trait they shared. Both were opportunists. Of the three of them, Reba currently occupied the power position. Ani knew the intimate details of Reba's relationship with Beck, but neither Beck nor Ani were aware that Reba had been tipped off about their affair. To further complicate the situation, I was reasonably sure Ani didn't know that Beck and Reba had reactivated their sexual connection. I felt a frisson of tension ripple up my spine, curious how Reba intended to play the hand she'd been dealt. Beck sat down in the remaining chair and slouched on his spine, extending his legs as though he were entitled to more space than we were. In the geography of body language, he and Ani were lined up in parallel, their bodies tracing the same angle while Reba sat across the table from them, her body an upright that cut across the slant of their respective postures. Ani's attention was fixed on her champagne flute. Beck sipped champagne, watching Reba above the rim of his glass. The blonde highlights in his hair must have been professionally applied. Certainly the haphazard thatch effect was no accident. "So, how's it going?" he asked. Reba said, "Not bad. I was actually thinking of coming back to work." Ani's expression was incredulous, as though Reba had farted in the presence of Elizabeth II. Reba ignored her reaction, addressing her remarks to Beck. "Yeah, I mentioned it to my parole officer, and she was all for it as long as my prospective employer knew about my past," she said, forming quote marks with her fingers. "I figured, who better than you?" Smoothly, he said, "Reeb, I'd love to help, but it doesn't seem smart." "It's ridiculous," Ani snapped. "You robbed him blind." Reba shifted her gaze. "Ani, I'm sorry, but you don't get it. Beck trusts me. He knows I'd do anything for him." She looked back at him. "Right?" Beck rearranged his legs, pulling himself into an upright position, his tone mild. "It's not a question of trust. There's no position. It's as simple as that. I wish we had an opening, but we don't."
"You could make one, couldn't you? I remember you did that for Abner."
"Different situation. Marty was overloaded and needed the help. I had no choice in that case."
"But you have one with me, is that it? You could choose to help me, but you won't?"
He reached out and grabbed one of her fingers, giving it a shake. "Hey, babe, remember I'm on your team." Reba studied him with care, the lean, handsome face, the hand touching hers.
"You said you'd take care of me. You owe me."
"Hey, anything you want, except work." Ani snorted and rolled her eyes.
"What gall! How do you have the fucking nerve to sit there and argue the point after what you did?"
Beck said, "Cool it, Ani. This is between her and me."
"Well, pardon the hell out of me. I just think someone should set this girl straight. She wreaked havoc on the company, and for what? So she could go on indulging herself, blowing every nickel she could get her hands on at the poker table? My God."
I half expected Beck to belt her in the mouth, but he focused on Reba's face. He took her hand, placing her index finger against his lip. The effect was erotic, some intensely private communication taking place between them.
"Forget about work. Take a little time for yourself. Do something nice, like that spa in Floral Beach. I can have Ed set it up. You've been through tough times, I understand that. But talk about work is premature."
"I have to do something with my life," she said, her eyes pinned on his.
"I know, babe, I hear you. All I'm saying is you need to take it slow. I don't want you rushing into anything you might regret."
Reba smiled.
"Like what? Coming back to work for you?"
"Like getting stressed out, upset, when there's no reason to. You need to keep it low key. Kick back and relax while you have the chance."
Annie said something under her breath. She shoved her arms into the sleeves of her jacket and shrugged herself into it, straightening her lapels. She reached for her cigarettes and tucked them in her bag, then stood, saying, "Night, folks. I'm out of here." Her manner seemed to be matter-of-fact, unless you knew what was going on. "Give me 5 minutes and I'll drive you home," Beck said to her. Annie's smile was brittle. "Thanks, but no thanks. I'd rather walk." "You won't make it a block in those heels." "Not your problem, champ. I'll figure it out."
"Oh, cut the crap, Annie. Have Jack call you a cab. I'll square the fare with him on my way out."
"Not to worry. I'm a big girl. I think I can manage to call a cab on my own. Meantime, enjoy Panama, and thanks for the drink. It was really swell, you fucking jerk."
Reba turned her head, watching as Annie walked away. "What's her problem?"
"Forget it. She gets bored any time the topic of conversation moves to something other than her," Beck said.
Reba said, "What's the deal with Panama? When did that come up?"
"Well, it's just a quick trip, couple of days."
"Why couldn't you take me with you? Like a mini-vacation. You could take care of business while I sit by the pool and get some sun. It'd be great."
"Baby, this is strictly solo. I've got wall-to-wall meetings. You'd be bored to tears."
"No, I wouldn't. I can amuse myself. Come on, Beck. We've hardly had a minute together. We could have a ball. Please, please, please."
He smiled. "You nut. I'd do it in a heartbeat if I thought we could get it past your P.O. Trust me, if you're not allowed to leave the state, you sure as hell wouldn't be allowed to leave the continental USA.
Reba made a face. "Oh, shit. You're right. I forgot about that. I don't even have a passport. It expired in June."
"So, get your passport renewed, and I'll take you to Panama as soon as you're out from under all the rules and regs."
He took a hasty look at his watch.
"Speaking of which, I gotta go. The limo's picking me up in an hour to drive to LAX.
"You're flying out tonight? Why didn't you tell me?"
Beck waved the idea away.
"I'm down there so often, it's not worth mentioning. Anyway, I'll call you as soon as I get back."
"Couldn't I ride down in the limo with you and come back with the driver once he drops you off?"
"It's an L.A.-based company. The driver's coming up from Santa Monica. Once he leaves me at the airport, he's on his way home."
"Shoot. I wanted to spend time with you."
"Me too. We'll take a rain check. Meantime, let's get you out of here. It's late."
Chapter 16. The three of us went out into the chill night air together as we had at Rosie's earlier in the week. I kept my distance, feigning interest in the lighted window display in the shop next door. Beck and Reba had a murmured conversation, their heads bent together like co-conspirators. Reba seemed to drink in the sight of him, her face in profile looking childlike and trusting. The revelation about Beck's relationship with Annie had apparently done nothing to mitigate his hold on her. It looked as if Chaney and Vince would have to find another source for confidential information. I only hoped she'd keep her mouth shut and not blow the whole deal. A valet pulled up in Reba's BMW. Beck slipped the guy a tip on her behalf and then turned as a second parking valet pulled his car in behind hers. Once Reba got in the car, she took out a lipstick and applied a fresh coat, checking her reflection in the rearview mirror. She caught sight of Beck behind her and waved to him, blowing him a kiss. She shifted into drive and turned right onto Coastal Road. I glanced back in time to see Beck pull out after we did. He made a left-hand turn heading toward West Glen Road. As soon as he was out of sight, Reba slowed, made a U-turn, and sped after him. "What are you doing?" I said.
"I want you to see his house."
"What do I care? At this hour, it's dark."
"It won't take long. It's just about a mile down West Glen."
"It's your car, so you can do as you please, but don't put yourself out on my account."
I couldn't get a fix on her mood. At first, I'd thought she was flirting with Beck purely to infuriate Annie. I was anticipating the rehash, the two of us comparing notes about Annie's reaction, especially when she walked out in such a huff. By that point in the evening, however,
Beck was really pouring on the charm, and she'd fallen under his spell. I found it unnerving how deftly he'd drawn her back into orbit, exerting the same invisible pull as the Earth on the moon. Just when I thought we'd won her over to our side, Beck had taken her back. We turned right on West Glen. Beck was now out of sight, several curves in the road between our car and his. Even if he noticed our headlights behind him, he probably wouldn't give the matter much thought. We reached the straightaway and caught sight of him about a quarter mile ahead. His brake lights came on as he slowed and made a right-hand turn. His car disappeared from view. Reba sped up, closing the distance, and then she slowed as well. She peered across me and out the passenger side window as we passed a gated estate. I caught a glimpse of a massive stone mansion in a fairyland of lights. 50 yards beyond the entrance to his property, she pulled onto the berm. She killed the lights, shut the engine down, and got out of the car. Before she eased the door shut, she said, "You coming or not?"
"Sure. 11 o'clock at night, I could use a walk."
I emerged from the car on my side. She made a point of not slamming her door, and I certainly knew better than to slam my own. If we were on a search-and-seizure mission of some kind, there was no point in alerting him to our presence. I joined her as she backtracked along the darkened road. Having spent half an hour in a smoke-filled bar, we must have smelled like 2 cigarette butts out for a breath of fresh air. This section of Montebello was dark. No streetlights, no sidewalks, and no passing cars. We were accompanied by the chirring of crickets and the scent of eucalyptus trees. She halted at the entrance to Beck's driveway. Through iron gates, I was treated to the full panoramic view. The ivy-covered stone facade looked as stately as a monastery, mansard roof, half-timbered, a long bank of mullioned windows aglow along the front. I was guessing 3 to 4 acres, with a tennis court visible on one side and a swimming pool on the other. Reba moved to the right of the gate and eased herself between the hedge and the stone pillar, where a gap permitted passage despite the solid look of the shrubs. I followed, pushing through a turnstile of branches that nearly tore off my shirt. She proceeded with an air of calm familiarity as she veered across the lawn. I gathered she'd made the walk many times before. She seemed confident about the absence of motion-detecting floodlights and attack-trained dogs. I was worried the automatic sprinkling system, complete with toe-busting sprayer heads, would suddenly spark to life and drench us in a downpour of artificial rain. Closer to the house, a porte cochere spanned the driveway and served as a covered walkway, sheltering residents and guests as they moved to and from their cars. Reba skirted the entrance and took up a position between 2 squared-off, clipped shrubs on the far side. The boxwoods had been shaped to form an alcove about the size of a phone booth, easily big enough to allow the two of us to huddle. A wide slat of shadow shielded us from view. We waited in silence. I love nighttime surveillance as long as my bladder isn't screaming for relief. Who wants to squat in the bushes where the high beams of any passing car can flash across the globes of your pearly hind end? Add to that the likelihood of peeing on your own shoes, and the notion of penis envy isn't tough to comprehend. A set of headlights appeared at the bottom of the drive, and a mechanical hum announced the slow parting of the wrought-iron gates. A black stretch limousine swung into view and proceeded slowly up the drive, approaching the house with all the gravity of the lead car in a funeral procession. The driver pulled under the porte cochere and triggered the trunk lid, which seemed to pop up of its own accord. As if on cue, the porch light went on and the front door was opened. I could hear Beck talking to someone over his shoulder as he carried out 3 large bags and set them on the porch. With the engine still idling, the driver got out in his tuxedo and chauffeur's cap and moved around to the rear where Beck waited with the luggage. The driver hefted the suitcases into the trunk one by one. He shut the trunk and then opened the rear limo door. Beck paused, looking toward the house as his wife stepped out onto the porch. She stopped, apparently to check the thumb lock before she pulled the door shut behind her. Is that everything?
We're good. Bags are in the trunk.
She crossed to the limo and ducked into the back seat. Beck followed her in. The driver closed the limo door and then returned to the driver's seat and resumed his place at the wheel, shutting the car door. I could hear a slight pop as he released the emergency brake, and then the limo glided down the drive toward the road. The lighted rear license plate read ST-Limo-1, designating car number 1 of the Santa Teresa Limousine Service. The gates swung open, the limo disappeared, and the gates eased shut again. Beside me, Reba flicked her Dunhill, the flame warming her face briefly as she took the first long drag from a fresh cigarette. She put the pack and lighter in her pocket and blew out a stream of smoke. Her eyes were remarkably large and dark, and her lips curved upward in a cynical smile. Lying sack of shit. You know when I figured it out? Did you see the little hitch in his walk when he first caught sight of me? That said it all. I was the last person in the world he wanted to see. At least you managed to queer it for Ani. She was really pissed at him. I hope so. Anyway, let's get out of here before a sheriff's deputy decides to cruise by. Beck always notifies him when he's leaving town. They're quite attentive to him. Are you okay? I feel great. How long will it take to set up the meeting with the feds? When I let myself into my apartment at 11:25, the light was blinking on the answering machine, a tiny red beacon in the dark. I flipped on the overhead light. I set my shoulder bag on the countertop and dumped my shopping bags on the floor. I crossed to the desk and stood there, staring at the blink, 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 as though it might be a message in Morse code. Either it was Cheney, or it was not. The fact of the matter had already been entered into evidence, so I might as well find out. If he hadn't called, that didn't necessarily mean anything, and if he had called, it didn't necessarily mean anything either. The problem in the early stages of any relationship is that you don't know where you stand, and you don't know how to interpret the other person's behavior. So, okay, all I had to do was push the button, and I'd know. I sat down. If he hadn't called, I sure didn't want to be the one to call him, though I was panting to tell him what had transpired between Beck and Reba. I could touch base with him for that purpose. In fact, I'd have to call him soon so he could set up the meeting between Reba and Vince. But aside from business, on a personal level, he'd have to make the first move. He looked like the kind of guy women called all the time, too cute and too sexy to have to expend much effort himself. I didn't want to place myself in the same category with his other women, whoever they were. How was it, though, that after only one day I was feeling insecure? Ruefully, I remembered my cockiness of the night before. I pushed the button and listened to the brief, high-pitched squeal as the tape rewound. Beep. Kinsey, this is Cheney. It's 10:15 and I just got off work. Give me a buzz when you get in. I'll be up. He left his number. Click. I checked the clock. Over an hour ago. I made a note of his home number, then suffered a fit of indecision. He said to call, so I'd call. Nothing tricky about that. Unless he was already in bed and asleep. I hate waking people up. Before I felt any more squirrely, I punched in the number. He picked up on the first ring. I said, "If you're asleep, I swear I'm going to slit my wrists with a butter knife." He laughed. "Not at all, babe. I'm a night owl. How about you?" "Not me. I'm an early bird. I usually get up at 6 for my run." "How come you were working so late? I thought you got off at 5. "We spent the day cooped up in a van over on Castle, taking videos of John's going in and out of a hot new whorehouse. Heavy weekend trade coming up. We'll do a sweep as soon as we have enough little fishies in the net. Nothing like sitting all day to wear you down.
I'm trashed. How about you?
I'm pretty trashed myself, I said. Though I did have a productive evening, you won't believe where I've been.
Answer can't be Rosie's, too easy.
I was out with Reba. First we went clothes shopping, and then we went to Bubbles, where we ran into Beck and Ani. I won't plague you with the details.
Hey, come on, don't be like that. I love details.
I'll tell you next time I see you. At the moment, I'm too bushed to go into a blow-by-blow. The upshot is Reba's ready to do business.
She's agreed to talk to Vince?
That's what she told me half an hour ago.
What brought this on? I know she was waffling, but this falls into the too-good-to-be-true category, don't you think?
No, I'm trusting her on this, mostly because I was right there watching when the whole thing went down. Beck laid on a bunch of BS, 3 or 4 lies in a row, and Reba nailed him on all counts. I mean, not to his face. He was stringing her along and stringing her along. I think she could have dealt with that. She's probably used to his messing with her head. The kicker was she realized he was taking Tracy to Panama when he implied he was going alone.
How'd she find out?
I hesitated. We did some independent research.
I don't want to hear this.
I thought not. Bottom line is, she'll meet with the feds as soon as you can set it up.
Shit, that's great. I'll let Vince know as soon as I can track him down. Might take a couple of days. He's hard to reach on weekends.
The sooner, the better. We don't want her changing her mind, I said.
While we're on the subject, Vince checked on that FBI guy who went to Reba's with the photos. Turns out he'd been transferred from another office and wanted to show how good he was at taking the initiative. He got his ears boxed, but good.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, I said.
So, what are you doing at the moment?
Are you down for the count?
Meaning what?
Am I in bed?
No, I'm up.
Meaning I don't want to keep you on the phone if you're about to hit the sack.
Not a bit of it. I just walked in the door.
I was worried I wouldn't catch you before you went to bed yourself.
There was a moment of quiet.
I said, hello?
I'm here. I was wondering how you'd feel about company.
Right now?
Yes.
I thought about exhaustion, both his and mine.
Good. I'd feel good.
Assuming it's yourself we're discussing and not someone else.
Give me 10 minutes.
Make it 15. That'll give me time to change.
I took the spiral stairs 2 at a time, whipped off my clothes, jammed everything in the hamper, showered, shaved my legs, washed my hair, flossed and brushed my teeth, all in the space of 8 minutes, which gave me plenty of time to pull on clean sweats, minus underwear, and change the sheets. Downstairs again, I was in the process of refolding sections of the newspaper when I heard his tap at the door. I tossed the dispatch in the wastebasket and let him in. His hair was curly and damp, and he smelled like soap. He was holding a pizza box that smelled heavenly. He closed the door behind him.
I never ate dinner. The guy just delivered this.
You hungry?
Of course.
You want to take it up with us?
He smiled, shaking his head fondly.
Always in a hurry.
We have time.
At 1 a.m., he gave me the promised haircut. Me sitting on a stool in the loft bathroom, with a towel draped across my shoulders, Cheney with a second towel wrapped around his waist. I said, most of the time I do this myself with a pair of nail scissors.
So I see.
He worked with ease and concentration, taking off very little hair, but somehow making the whole of it fall together in tidy layers. I watched his reflection in the mirror.
So serious.
Where'd you learn to cut hair?
I have an uncle who does this for a living. Salon on Melrose. Hair cutter to the stars. $400 a pop. I figured if I washed out of police academy, I could do this instead. I'm not sure which option was more horrifying to my parents, my becoming a cop or a guy who does women's hair. They're otherwise decent folks, barring the inherent snobbery.
Last time I had a really good cut, you know who did it?
Danielle Rivers. I remember that. Cheney's attention had shifted to the nape of my neck, where he was busy snipping away, trying to even out the line. Danielle Rivers was a 17-year-old hooker he'd introduced me to. He'd recently been transferred to Vice, part of the regular rotation system at the police department, while I'd been hired to track down the killer of Lorna Kepler, a beautiful young woman who was caught up in porno films and sex for hire. He'd put me together with Danielle because she and the victim had been cohorts. I said, Danielle was appalled when she heard how little I earned, half of what she made. He should have heard her riff on investment strategies, all of which he picked up from Lorna. I wish I'd taken her advice. Maybe I'd be rich. Easy come, easy go. Remember the sandwiches you bought in the hospital cafeteria the night she was admitted? He smiled. Man, those were bad. Ham and cheese from a vending machine. But you added all the stuff that made them edible. He gave me a hand mirror and kissed me on the top of the head, saying, All done. I turned, holding the mirror so I could check the cut in the back. Oh, wow, it looks good. Thanks. I glanced down at his towel, the two ends of which had parted in front. I like your friend. Must be showtime. He's popped his head out to check the audience. Cheney glanced down. Why don't we go in the other room and see if we can catch his act? Eventually, we slept, curled together like cats. Chapter 17. Friday morning, we dragged ourselves out of bed at 10. We showered and dressed and then walked over to Cabana Boulevard, where we had breakfast at a little beachside cafe. Cheney didn't have to go to work until later in the day, having been scheduled for another shift in the surveillance van. Back from breakfast, we stood and chatted at the curb until we ran out of things to say. We parted company at noon. He had errands to run, and I was ready to be alone. I watched until his little red Mercedes disappeared from sight, and then I followed the walkway around to the backyard. Henry was kneeling in one of his flower beds where nutgrass was popping up. He was barefoot, wearing cutoffs and a tank top, his flip-flops lying on the lawn nearby. Eliminating nutgrass requires patience. The weed multiplies by way of thread-like roots and tiny black rhizomes that spread underground, so simply yanking the stems free does nothing to the plant's underlying structure, which goes on merrily reproducing. The small pile of weeds Henry had successfully uprooted resembled nothing so much as a cluster of spiders with frail legs and bodies the size of blackened match heads. You need help? No, but you can keep me company if you like. There's something satisfying about going after these things. Ugly-looking little buggers, aren't they? Disgusting. I thought you got rid of all the nutgrass this spring. Ongoing process. You never really win. He sat back on his heels briefly, then shifted so he could tackle the next section. I kicked off my tennis shoes and settled in the grass, letting the sunshine wash across my legs. Henry's dark mood had lifted, and while he was still subdued, he seemed almost himself again. I see you had company last night, he remarked without looking at me. I laughed, feeling the blush begin to mount in my cheeks. That was Cheney Phillips, STPD. He's a friend of Lieutenant Dolan's, I said as though that were relevant. Nice? Very. We've known each other for years. I thought it must be something of the sort. I've never known you to be impulsive. Actually, I am. It just sometimes takes me a while to work up to it. There was a companionable quiet, broken only by the sound of Henry's trowel chunking in the ground. Finally, I said, Is Lewis still in town? He flies home tomorrow. I feel better about him, in case you're wondering. I don't want to see him just yet, but we'll work it out in due course. What about Maddie? Oh, that's probably for the best. I never expected the relationship to turn into anything serious. But it might have. Might doesn't count for much.
I generally find it wiser to deal with what is than what might have been. Having made it to the ripe old age of 87 without a long-term romance, there's no reason to suppose I'm even capable of such a thing. Couldn't you at least call? I could, though I'm not sure what that would accomplish. She made her feelings clear. I have nothing else to offer and nothing much to add. What if she called you? That's up to her, he said. I don't mean to sound like a sad sack. I'm really fine. Well, of course you're fine, Henry. It's not like you're crushed because you've dated her for years. On the other hand, I thought you were great together. I'm sorry things didn't work out. You were picturing what? A little trip down the aisle? William got married at 87. Why not you? He's impetuous by nature. I'm a stick in the mud. I threw a handful of grass at him. You are not. Reba called at 5, interrupting what I realized in retrospect was an award-winning nap. I'd stretched out on the bed with my favorite John le Carré spy novel. The light was soft, the temperature was mild, and the sheet I'd thrown over me was the perfect weight. Outside, I could hear the dim buzz of a lawnmower, followed by the ft-ft-ft of Henry's rain bird, firing jets of water across the newly trimmed grass. Thanks to my sleep deprivation of the past 2 nights, I sank out of consciousness like a flat stone settling lazily to the bottom of a lake. I don't know how long I might have gone on like that if the phone hadn't rung. I put the handset to my ear and said, "Uh-huh. This is Reba. Did I wake you?" "I greatly fear you did. Oh, what's the time?" 5 minutes after 5. I checked the skylight, squinting in an attempt to determine if the sun was coming up or going down. A.M. or P.M.? "It's Friday afternoon. I was just wondering what you'd heard from your guys." "Nothing so far. Cheney's currently on surveillance, but I know he's trying to reach his contact in Washington, D.C. It may take a few days to set up the meeting. With so many agencies involved, the protocol's tricky to negotiate." "I wish they'd get on with it. Beck's back Sunday night. I don't want to have to deal with him if I'm doing this." "I can appreciate that. Unfortunately, Cheney's dependent on other people, and he can only push so hard. Doesn't help we have a weekend coming up." "I guess. You want to go someplace later? We could have dinner." "That sounds good. What time?" "Soon or right away, whichever one comes first." "What did you have in mind? You want to meet me somewhere?" "You decide. All I know is I got to get out before I lose my mind." I could hear her pause to light a cigarette. "What's making you so itchy?" I said. "I don't know. I've been feeling anxious all day, like maybe there's a drink or a poker parlor coming up real soon." "You don't want to do that." "Easy for you to say. I'm already back to smoking a pack a day." "I could have told you not to start." "I couldn't help myself." "So you said." "Personally, I don't buy it. You either take charge of your life or you might as well give up." "I know, but I've been feeling so bad. I know Beck's a shit, but I really love the guy."
"You love the guy?"
"Well, not now, but I did. Doesn't that count for something?"
"Not in my opinion."
"Also, you know, as odd as it sounds, I kind of miss being locked up."
"You're kidding."
"I'm not," she said. "In prison, I didn't have to make all these decisions, so that limited my chances of screwing up. Out here, what's the incentive to behave?"
I pinched the bridge of my nose in despair.
"Where are you now? At your dad's?"
"Yeah. And you'll never guess who came waltzing in for a visit with him."
"Who?"
"Lucinda. The woman who hoped to marry him?"
"The very one," she said. "She'd love to see me violate parole. I get tossed in the can again, she'll whip back into Pop's life before the doors slam shut."
"Oh, then you better pull yourself together.
That'd be easier to do if I could have a drink. Or maybe I could drop in at the Double Down and just watch. No harm in that."
"Would you cut the crap?" You can do anything you want, but don't kid yourself. You're just looking for an excuse to self-destruct.
Yeah, it might be a relief.
Look, why don't I hop in the car and come get you?
I don't know.
Now that I think about it, maybe that's not such a hot idea. If I leave Lucinda alone with him, she'll find a way to make trouble.
Oh, come on. What can she do? Your father told me he was done with her.
Oh, she'll manage somehow. I've seen her do it before. Pop's like me, weak-willed and indecisive, only not as hell-bent. Besides, if he's so done with her, how come she's sitting in the other room?
Would you quit obsessing about her?
She's the least of your worries. Look, give me a minute to throw on some clothes and I'll be up.
Are you sure you want to go out?
Sure, I'm sure. Why don't you start walking down the drive and I'll meet you at the gate? In the car on the way over, I tried to assess the situation. Reba was on the verge of coming unglued. Since the moment she'd fired up that first cigarette, I'd been waiting for signs of emotional decompression. After 2 years at CIW, she was unaccustomed to real-world conflicts and real-world consequences. Prison, while loathsome, apparently provided a form of containment that must have made her feel safe. Now there was too much to deal with, and no way for her to assimilate the impact. Bad enough to find out Beck had hoodwinked her into taking the fall for him. Worse still, to discover he'd launched into an affair with the woman she'd thought of as her best friend. She was tough enough to acknowledge his deception, but perhaps not tough enough to make the break. I could see her ambivalence. She'd been dependent on him for years. What worried me was the fact she had so little tolerance for stress. If the meeting with Vince Turner had been scheduled right away, she might have sailed right on through, spilling everything she knew. With the delay of even 3 days, she was in danger of losing control. And while she wasn't my responsibility, I was party to the push that had her teetering on the brink. When I arrived at the estate, she was perched on a big sandstone boulder to the right of the gate. In a navy blue windbreaker, jeans, and tennis shoes, she sat with her knees drawn up, cigarette in hand. When she saw me, she took one last drag and then scrambled to the ground. The moment she got in the car, I could feel the nervous energy pouring out of her like heat. Her movements were agitated, and her eyes were too bright.
"What'd you do to your hair?" she asked.
"Got it cut."
"It looks good."
"Thanks." I put the car in reverse and did a 3-point turn. She craned her neck and looked back at the gate.
Oh, I just hope she's gone by the time I get back. I couldn't believe she showed up like that, unannounced.
How do you know she didn't call him in advance?
That's even worse. If he agreed to see her, he's crazier than I am.
Hey, take a deep breath and get a grip. You're all over the place.
Sorry. I feel like there's someone inside trying to crawl out through my skin. I wish I had a guy. I'd rather have a drink, but getting laid would help.
Call your sponsor. Isn't that what they're for?
I haven't found one yet.
Then call Priscilla Holloway.
I'm fine. Don't worry about it. I've got you, she said and laughed.
Yeah, right. This is way beyond me.
Well, me too, you know. I'm just trying to muddle through the same as anybody else.
She was quiet for a moment, staring out the window.
Fuck it. Never mind, I could tough it out on my own.
As you so amply demonstrated in the past, I said.
Well, you're so smart. What do you suggest?
Find a meeting.
Where?
How do I know? We'll go to my place and check the yellow pages. There's bound to be a listing for AA. Once we reached my apartment, it took less than a minute to look up the number and make the requisite phone call. As it turned out, the closest meeting was at the City Recreation Center, 4 blocks away. I drove her myself, not trusting her to make it on her own. "I'll be back to pick you up in an hour," I said, as she got out of the car. The slamming of the door was as much as I received in the way of a reply. I made a point of waiting until I saw her walk in the door, and then I waited another minute in case she intended to sneak out again. I could see how an alcoholic's family became ensnared in the game. I was already battling an urge to monitor her every move. That or wash my hands of her altogether and be done with it. If I hadn't been intent on keeping her under wraps until she met with Vince, I might have cut her loose. To kill time, I circled back to my neighborhood and parked outside of Rosie's. And yes, I recognized the irony of waiting for Reba in a bar while she struggled with the urge to have a drink. Louis was there, tending bar by himself, an apron tied around his waist. Two day drinkers had taken up residence at the far end of the room. The color television mounted in the corner was tuned to a golf tournament being played someplace green. Rosie must have been back in the kitchen doing dinner prep because the place smelled like sautéed onions. She was also doing something with fried kidneys I didn't want to know about. I perched on a bar stool and ordered a Coke. I honestly might have minded my own business if Louis hadn't seemed so chipper and oblivious. He gave no indication that he regretted or even recognized the trouble he'd caused. He set my Coke on the bar, saying, "Where's Henry? I haven't seen him the last couple of days." I studied him. "You really don't know." "What? Is something wrong with him?" I debated for half a second and then said, "Look, I know this is none of my business, but I think William was out of line when he talked you into flying out. Henry and Mattie were doing fine until you showed up." Louis blinked at me as though I were speaking in tongues. "I don't understand. You didn't have to barge in on breakfast and ask her for a date." "I didn't ask her for a date. I suggested an art exhibit and a bite of lunch." "Out here, we call that a date." "Henry was upset, and rightly so," I said. Louis seemed bewildered. "He was upset with me?" "Sure he was. She was supposed to be spending time with him." "Why didn't he speak up?" "How could he? You called him a little old lady, in front of Mattie, no less. He was mortified. He couldn't speak up without looking even more foolish than he already felt." "But that was just good-natured jostling. It was a joke." "It's not a joke when you hustle in and try to beat him to the punch. Life's complicated enough. But we've always competed for the ladies. It's all in good fun. Neither of us takes it seriously. For heaven's sake, ask William if you doubt my word." "He's never going to cop to it. He set the whole thing up. He had no business meddling, but what you did was worse. You knew Henry was interested in her."
"Of course he is, and I am too. That was obvious on the cruise. I made my pitch and he made his. If he can't handle the challenge, why complain to me?"
Mattie broke it off. She said she didn't want to see him again. Disconcerted, Louis said,
"Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but it's got nothing to do with me."
"Yes, it does. You flew out to California and got right in the middle of something that was none of your concern. There's nothing good-natured about that. You were being hostile."
"No, no, not a bit of it. I can't believe you're saying this. I'd cut off my right arm before I'd do such a thing."
"But you did it, Louis."
"You're completely wrong. That wasn't my intention. Henry's always been my favorite. He knows I'm crazy about him."
"Then you'd better find a way to make amends," I said. It was close to 8 when Reba emerged from her AA meeting and headed toward my car. It was still light out. A massive fog bank hovered on the horizon, and the breezes coming off the ocean laid a chill in the air. "Feel better?"
"Not especially, but I'm glad I went."
"You still want to have dinner?"
"Shit, we have to go back to the house. I forgot the photographs."
"Why do you need those?"
"Visual aids," she said. "There's a guy I want you to meet. He has dinner the same place every Friday night at 9. I did some reconnoitering this morning just to satisfy a hunch. We'll make a run up to Pop's for the pics, have a heart-to-heart with my pal, and then take some time to explore."
"Isn't a 9 o'clock dinner kind of late?"
"I hope so. Prison, you eat at 5 in the afternoon. Talk about depressing. Makes you feel like a kid."
She turned in her seat.
"Why are you going this way? You should have taken a right back there."
"Actually, we don't need to go to your house. I have a set of pictures at my office.
Cheney gave them to me. I wondered if she'd question my having copies of the photos, but she was sidetracked by something else and gave me a speculative look.